thing I was reminded of in the break, I had actually meant to make an announcement at the beginning, was that there was one sad bit of news that I found in my email this morning, which came from Barak Kohl in Jerusalem, and he was letting a number of people know that, in fact, Jacob Bekenstein passed away on the weekend.
Oh, shit.
And so there, well, I think Jacob's work now about 40 years ago is really what inspired and provided the foundation for everything that, is developing in such an exciting way these days, and is at the root of much of our discussions here today, or in this workshop. And so what we would like to do is, in fact, then dedicate this workshop to the memory of Jacob Bekenstein. So I just wanted to let everybody know about that sad bit of news. And at that point, I'm going to hand it over to Matt, who's going to give us a new perspective on holographic entanglement. So, Matt.
Thanks, Rob, and thanks for inviting me to what promises to be an exciting, should I call it, Bekenstein workshop on quantum information and quantum gravity. And I guess it's fitting. I was going to start anyway with Bekenstein-Hawking entropy, so that fits well. By the way, somebody can take my seat there. I'm not planning to sit there during my talk, so any people who are standing. What I'm going to talk about is holographic entanglement entropy. You won't be surprised to hear, but I'll start with a maybe slightly broader perspective. So by now, we're very used to the idea that in quantum gravity, there's some relation between areas and entropies. And two classic examples. Well, the first example was indeed the Bekenstein-Hawking entropy. So you have some black hole. This is my most accurate depiction of a black hole. And Bekenstein and Hawking taught us that it has an entropy, which is given by the area of the horizon in Planck units. Then we have the Ryutaki-Inagi formula, which tells us that in a holographic theory, given some boundary region, so my boundary is here, this is my bulk, given some boundary region, you look for the minimal surface in the bulk, and the area of that tells you the associated entanglement entropy of the boundary region. And then there are more examples, for example, the Bekenstein bound, Ted Jacobson's work, and so on, Busso bound, etc. So I could give more examples of this relation between areas and entropies, which is now part of the our understanding of quantum gravity, and I would say part of our limited understanding of quantum gravity, because one of the things that this relation tells us is, to some extent, what we don't understand. Because we know that it's true in these cases, but I think it's fair to say that we don't really understand why it's true or how generally it's true. What's going on? Okay, what is the reason for this connection? And you know, so the first thing that pops to mind is that since we have such a definite and quantitative relationship, which is telling us essentially that there's one bit of information about the microstate in each Planck area of surface area, that maybe one bit lives on each microstate, and that's the explanation. So that essentially you should think of the microstates as the bits that store the microstates in some sense as living on the horizon or living on the minimal surface. So each little Planck area here contains one bit in some sense. So, I mean, what one of the things that the Ryu-Takayanagi formula does for us, and I should have said, is it actually gives us a little more flexibility than Bekenstein-Hawking, and in certain circumstances, Bekenstein-Hawking is actually a special case of Ryu-Takayanagi, but what we can do with this that we can't do with that is to vary, we have a new variable, and by varying that variable, we can ask whether this makes sense. And so I just want to, I mean, I will admit that what I'm doing here is a little bit of a straw man. But I just sort of want to point out some conceptual issues with trying to say that there's something special about the minimal surface, that something special is going on the, that that's a special place in the bulk that is somehow storing some data. Okay, so I mean, one thing is that we can, as we vary A, the minimal surface can actually jump from one place to another. It may not move continuously. So classic example, so let's say I actually have two regions, and let's say I'm interested in the union, so I'm actually computing this, then my minimal surface, I should probably use some color here, can jump from, depending on, as so let's say I use as my parameter the separation between these regions, then at large separation, the minimal surface will simply be, so I can have the minimal surface for the union being the union of the respective minimal surfaces. Or when I bring them together, then the minimal surface will jump. There'll be competing saddles, essentially. And instead, I'll have something that actually joins them. So this might be, maybe we'll call it M1. And then we'll have M2. And so that seems odd to say that, well, if when the... surface, when the regions are this close together, the special place in the space-time is here. And then all of a sudden, the special place in the space-time is over here. And in fact, one can argue, as I did in a paper a couple of years ago, that actually, although this looks like a phase transition, it's reminiscent of a phase transition, and the first derivative with respect to this coordinate, the separation, is discontinuous, first derivative of the entropy, it's not actually a phase transition in the conventional sense of an exchange of dominance between macro states. I don't want to go through that now, but there's reasons to believe that actually from the point of view of the reduced density matrix of the AB system here, nothing actually interesting is happening at this point when there's this exchange of dominance. So that seems quite odd. And then related to this is what's going on with the... these quantities that you can derive from the entanglement entropy, which, so the entanglement entropy is kind of like raw data, and then you want to process it to learn something about, for example, correlations in your system. So one of the simplest things you can do is you can compute the mutual information. And it's very odd, actually. So this quantity tells you the total amount of correlation between A and B, correlation and entanglement. And yet here, let's say we're in the situation where, in fact, the dominant one is M2. And then, S of A is given by this surface, S of B by this one, and S of AB by this one. So now, to compute this quantity, which is telling me something very important about the degree to which the degrees of freedom here and here are correlated with each other, I subtract these areas which are running through, which are of surfaces running through different parts of the space-time. Okay, so I just do this plus, it's like this rule, this plus this minus this. Okay, if it's true that the bits lived here, why am I subtracting bits that live here from bits that live here? And let me just remind you of what, you know, where does this formula come from? Why is it that we would do this subtraction? And from an information theoretic viewpoint, it's very simple. Let me first do the classical picture. So, and I'm sure this is quite familiar to most of you. So classically, you can always encode A and B so that they share a certain number of bits, and they don't share a certain number of bits. So these are my, so I encode A in some number of bits, in S of A bits. So this number is S of B. This is S of A. And then it's simple. So, and then what I mean by this is that in the state of the AB system, this bit equals this one, whereas this one is independent. So these are all independent bits, except this one equals this, and so on. Okay. And so the overlap is, as you can see, the mutual information. So it's simply the number of shared bits. In the quantum case, of course, the bits may be actually entangled with each other, in which case they don't contribute at all to S of AB, and so they actually contribute two to any entangled pair of bits between A and B contributes two to this mutual information. And by the way, it's useful also, I'll refer to this later, to name the overhang, which is the amount of information in A that's not in B, which is the conditional entropy. And here we have. So these differences, oh, and this thing is S of AB minus S of A. I think that's, okay, so this total here is S of AB. I've run out of space, so I can't write that, but the total number of bits here is S of AB. And so these formulas should be obvious. So that's why, from an information theoretic viewpoint, we are subtracting entropies of different systems. Okay, now we go back to this picture. Okay, and it's not clear what any of these quantities, although of course it's simple enough to calculate them, given this formula, what they have to do with the what these differences, why these differences in areas of surfaces that pass through different parts of the spacetime should tell you these quantities. Okay, and then similarly, this is just all kinds of versions of the same complaint, essentially. The proof of properties like strong sabbativity, which information theoretically means that the amount of correlation is monotone under inclusion, and it's well known that this can be proven by cutting and pasting surfaces. So you're doing this proof, which involves cutting and pasting surfaces, and a priori the proof has nothing to do with the meaning of the inequality, which is very simple, which is just that if I adjoin some other system, it cannot decrease the amount of correlation that I have with my first system. Okay, so these things have always sort of bothered me about this formula, and have made me wonder whether it's true that one should think of the minimal surface as being a special place where something special is going on in the bulk. And so what I want to do today is actually to, I think essentially, well, let's say make some progress in resolving these issues by rewriting this same formula. So I'm not going to change the formula, just going to change how it's written. And so what I write will be completely equivalent to this. But the new way of writing it, the minimal surface will not appear. And so the minimal surface will essentially lose its special status. Okay. And the way that I'm going to do that is by using a theorem, which is called, which is fairly well known in various areas of applied math and so on. Although the version I'll use it in is not so well known, which is called min-cut max-flow. So this is a theorem originally from network theory, but I should say, by the way, that this theorem in its network or graph theoretic incarnation was recently applied to understanding entanglement entropies in a toy model of holography by this Harlow and Friends collaboration. So what is the theorem? So it's very simple. I won't state the network version of it. I'll just state the version I'll need, which is in the context of Riemannian geometry, differential geometry. So we have some Riemannian manifold with boundary. You actually, for the statement of the theorem, you don't need the boundary, but for the application, I need the boundary. So I'll just put the boundary in from the beginning. And I'll draw it suggestively, kind of like this at first. I have some various holes in it, kind of like a set of pipes with an input and an output. So this is my M. And then I want to define on this something called a flow. I take it back. Okay. So what is a flow? So a flow is a vector field satisfying two properties. First of all, its norm is less than or equal to 1, and it's divergenceless. The fact that it's divergenceless, let me pick out some part of the boundary. I'll call this A. And then I'm interested in this quantity, the integral on A of V, by which I mean the flux through A. Okay, so I mean I should write V dot n, where n is the unit normal, blah, blah, blah. I hope it's clear enough. I'll just write integral of on A of V, meaning the flux through A of V. By this condition, this is equal to the integral through any other representative of the same homology class. And by this condition, if you think about it, this can't be more than the area of that representative. So if I pick any other representative of the same homology class, then the flux is bounded by the area of that representative, which means it's bounded by the area of the smallest representative. Okay? So far that's simple enough, but then the theorem actually says that that bound is attained. Okay? In other words, or can be attained. In other words, there exists a flow V satisfying these conditions whose flux equals the smallest area representative. Okay? That's the theorem. Because I need that picture. All right. Terrible board work. The theorem says that the maximum over all flows V of this flux is equal to the minimum area, the minimum over all representatives of the homology cycle of the area. Okay, so as I emphasized before, I hope it's clear, one direction of this is trivial, just straight from the definitions, that no flow can exceed in its flux the area of any representative, therefore the area of the smallest representative. The non-trivial thing is the existence of a flow which saturates that bound. Okay? And if you think about it, in order to saturate this bound, the flux on that minimal area representative had better have the highest magnitude possible, namely one, and furthermore had better be aligned with the normal. So on M of A, which is my minimal representative, M of A is my minimal representative. On that minimal representative, the flux, the flow, sorry, has to equal the unit normal on M of A. This thing is the maximum flow. And so on M of A, this vector field is fixed, but it's very important to understand that off of M of A, it's very floppy. Okay, so and in fact, okay, so let me now redraw it in the sort of in making a more holographic cartoon of this. So let's say A is my region, like over there, and then I'm going to have some flow which I can represent because of the divergenceless condition. I can represent in terms of the flow line. So it's very useful actually to think about it in terms of the flow lines. So I'll have some flow lines. So, and the point is that on the minimal surface, the flow lines, that's where they're most tightly packed together. But away from it, if you think about it, they have tons of freedom. They're very floppy. Okay, the flow lines are very floppy away from M of A. Okay, so in here, for example, I can move them around all because there's a ton of space out here near the boundary, and there's a ton of space out here. Okay. Okay. So even though M of A is generically unique, what I call V of A, you have a huge amount of freedom in choosing V of A. Okay? There isn't a definite V of A. Okay, so now we're off to the races because here's my Ryu Takayanagi formula in its new incarnation. Which doesn't mention the minimal surface at all. It's the maximum flow through A. The maximum flux through A of any flow. Okay, very simple. And now I want to rewrite this in yet another way. Which is supposed to be suggestive. So I want to go back to this picture of the flow lines. And the point is that the flow lines, again, cannot be packed together more than is allowed by that condition. How should I think of this? Well, if I think of the magnitude of V as being the transverse density of flow lines, the number of flow lines per unit crossing a given small area, then essentially what I'm saying is that the number of flow lines per transverse area can't be more than one per Planck area, up to units, up to fours or whatever. So in other words, each flow line has a thickness. So these flow lines actually have some size. They have some transverse area. They cannot be packed together arbitrarily closely. And each one has a thickness of one Planck area. Okay? So I can write this way. This is the maximum number of threads. So I'll call the flow lines threads. Subject to this rule, and I guess it's four Planck areas.
Mm-hmm. So far we're strictly spatial.
Oh yeah, the whole talk. Well, essentially the whole talk. Okay. We're strictly, the whole talk is static. Okay. Yeah. Great. So now we have this new way of writing it, where essentially, what is the minimal surface doing now? The minimal surface does not appear in the formula, but what it's doing essentially, it's kind of behind the scenes. It's enforcing. It's the obstruction to adding more threads. So think about it this way. Your job in calculating S of A is to stick as many threads into the bulk as you possibly can. You just keep stuffing them in one after another, okay? And you're quite free in how you put them in, but at some point you'll discover you just cannot jam one more in. Then you're done. Why can't you jam one more in? Because there's a bottleneck somewhere where they're already maximally tightly packed together. If you care to look where that you may not care where the bottleneck is, but if you happen to care where the bottleneck is, you will discover M of A. M of A is the bottleneck. Okay? Yeah.
So operationally, if you were to calculate S of A in some given space-time, then you would first find the minimal surface, or is there a...
Well, that would be one way to do it. Actually, there are various... I'm not an expert on this, but there are various areas of, for example, image processing where they do it the other way. So they're interested in finding minimal surfaces subject to various constraints and whatever. And they actually apply maxful min cut as an algorithm. So they actually add threads essentially until they can't anymore and find. So I can actually imagine applying this as a numerical algorithm in, you know, sufficiently complicated situation to actually compute entanglement entropies. So, but obviously one can do it the other way also and use more conventional methods to find the minimal surface first. Okay, so my point in this talk is going to be more conceptual.
Algorithmically, is the max cut algorithm somehow more efficient?
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, for certain problems, that's how you do it. I mean, don't ask me why, but this is a whole area. There's like a massive area of like obviously image processing, you know, which is probably larger than all of physics, where people think a lot about how to optimize these, and that's at least one thing they do. Okay, I want to say something about this freedom. So at first it might seem like a bit of a weirdness, but I want you to think of this freedom as like a gauge freedom, and we're used to the fact that gauge freedoms actually hold some, you know, important physical content. And again, so this floppiness in the where you put the threads is going to be important. It's going to give important information. Okay, so how does this solve my objections? First of all, you can see that if I continuously vary A, let's say, while the bottleneck may jump, the threads don't jump. Okay, the threads will move continuously. Okay. I should have said something else. Just about the interpretation. You know what you should think of is that each thread represents, it essentially carries one bit of information about the microstate of A, one independent bit of information. So each thread carries an independent bit from the other ones. And that's why the number of them is equal to S of A in this interpretation, kind of trying to reverse engineer this formula. You can also ask, well, where do the threads end? And they can either end on a complement, or if there's a black hole in the bulk, they can end on the horizon. And if they end on a complement, then you should think of them as representing a bit of entanglement between a and a complement. If they end on the horizon, then you're in a mixed state, and they represent one bit of the mixedness of the full system. Okay? Now let's kind of test this interpretation a little bit more, and let's talk about what happens when you have multiple regions. And you'll see how this works out very nicely. Now the thing is that if I want to compute S of A, I maximize the number of threads coming out of A. If I want to compute S of B, I maximize the number coming out of B. But I may not be able to do both. It may be one or the other, because AB may have some bottleneck which is smaller than A plus B, than the bottleneck of A plus the bottleneck of B. Okay? So I may not be able to maximize through A and through B simultaneously, because they may have some joint bottleneck which is too tight to allow that.
If the whole thing is a pure state, then you can
A and B are not, A is not the complement of B. A and B are just two disjoint regions.
But if you thought of the thing as compact, then B and B complement can be, if the whole state is pure, B and B complement can be identified, and then A and B complement are necessary. And then you could maximize both.
No, that would be a different. Because what you're doing there is you're minimizing one of the you made a sign error in that logic. So I can show you. Even if the whole thing is pure, whatever, it's still the case that you may not be able to maximize A and B simultaneously. So let's just do an example, a simple example. So let's say, for example, that S of A and S of B are both 2. This is a toy example. And S of AB is only 3. Okay, so then the mutual information is 1. Okay, so here I'm going to first try to put my threads leaving A, so I can do at most 2 leaving A. And now I try to put them on B, but I can put at most 1 out of B. And then I'm stuck. Okay, or I can do this. So, this flow, I'm going to call V of A comma B, and what it means is that what this means is that you first maximize on A, then on B, and having done that, so the flux. So if I write something like this, the flux of this through A is S of A, but the flux of this through B is not S of B, because I've maximized through B subject to a constraint. However, the flux of this through AB is S of AB, because essentially this is one way that I can maximize on AB, is first on A, then on B. Okay?
Why?
Why what?
Why is the flux on AB S of AB? Because the constraint is.
Yeah, that's a theorem, actually. So I tried to pretend like it's obvious, but it's a theorem that if you have a nested, like if I consider A and AB, I can simultaneously maximize the flux through A and AB. That's a theorem. It's essentially, yeah, it's something else you have to prove, but it is true. If anybody in the audience is like, you know, knows this stuff, and if I say Ford-Fulkerson, it means something to you, it's like an easy exercise to use Ford-Fulkerson to prove what I just said. If not, just take it as a fact. Let me write what I just said so that it's clear. Integral on A of V of A comma B equals S of A, by definition, and integral on AB of V of AB equals S of AB. But for B, it's not true. Okay, so now let's talk about first doing B B then A. So now I put two leaving B, but now I can put at most one leaving A. Okay. All right, so what just happened between these two? What happened is that I have three threads total leaving AB. One of them can be moved. One of them is stuck on A, one is stuck on B, and one can be moved. The number that can be moved is the mutual information. It's the mutual information because that's the number of bits that are redundant between A and B. Okay, so in row of AB, A and B share one bit. Okay? So in this example, so the lesson is that the number of threads that are movable, that are free to move, between A and B is the mutual information.
There are no threads that they start in A and
it's coming. B. It's coming. It's coming. Yeah. But first I want to say one other thing, which is that the number of threads that are stuck on A is the conditional entropy. And in fact, so let me make that precise with a formula. So H of A given B is by definition S of AB minus S of B. I'm going to evaluate these using this one because this tells me both S of B and S of AB. So I get integral on AB V of B comma A minus integral on B V of B comma A, but that is nothing but the flux through A . So in other words, if you want to know the conditional entropy, you find yourself the flux which maximizes on A subject to maximizing first on B, conditioned on maximizing first on B, that flux through A is the conditional entropy. You see, there's this very nice one-to-one correspondence developing between, on the one hand, these geometrical quantities, the fluxes, and on the other hand, their information theoretic meanings. That's my goal, okay? Now, this example was, whoops, that wasn't far enough. Okay, this example was one where the conditional entropy was positive. The sign, one sign that you must have entanglement is when your conditional entropy is negative. If your conditional entropy is negative, you must have entanglement. Is that going to stay? Is that going to stay? No? Should I say? Oh, I see. Oh, that's what the erasers are for. Okay. All right. So let's do an example so this is example one. Let's do an example where the conditional entropy is negative. So I'll do the same thing, but now I'll, for A and B, but now I'll put this very narrow bottleneck on AB. Okay, so now I try to figure out what V of AB is. So first I maximize on A, and I put one thread. And then the second one, because of this bottleneck, cannot leave AB. It has only one place it can go, cannot leave AB, so it must end on B. Okay? And the other way around, so that was V of AB. The other way around, I first maximize on B, and now it must go to A. So one thread moved, and the other thread connected them and switched direction. Okay? And indeed, what we have in this situation is a conditional entropy, which is minus one, indicating that there's one entangled bit and or pair of bits, and a mutual information, which is three, because one of classical correlation and one of entanglement, and entanglement counts double. Okay? So the lesson here is that a thread connecting A to B and switching direction represents one entangled pair of bits. Now, that means that in particular, if I go back here, you see here, nothing stopped me from dividing my A arbitrarily into subregions. And then what I'm arguing here is that this floppiness reflects the fact that within A, there's an enormous amount of correlation. So therefore, I can move these threads around at will, especially the part near the boundary. Also, there's another freedom which I didn't mention, which is that there's so much room near the boundary that I can actually, without violating these rules, I can add threads that go that attach the boundary to them to itself within A. So I have this freedom to add threads that go from A to A. And again, that reflects the fact that there's a lot of entanglement within A. Okay? Yeah.
The way you formulated it there, it sounds almost as if you had an EPR pair with one component in A and one in B. But that would have been some sort of a physical statement about the state as such, without specifying what your region A and what your region B was. But the flow does depend on your specification of what your region
right.
A
so you shouldn't is. Think of you shouldn't think of the you know, if I give you a particular flow and I happen to have a flow line which ends at some point, you should not attach too much significance to that point where that flow line happens to end. Right, precisely because of this freedom. So you shouldn't say, oh, there's a bit living here and another bit living here, and this bit living here is entangled. That's way too naive. Okay, we know that's way too naive, right? So this is more about, I mean, there's some, you know, very complicated density matrix for A where the different parts of A are highly entangled and correlated with each other in some very complicated way. And this is one way of kind of seeing how that's reflected. Yeah.
So are the these always just associated with one region, or is it possible to fix some of that? Is it possible to find a V that serves, that, you know, gives the right V for multiple different, for a family of regions, and therefore sort of fix some of the freedom?
Yeah, absolutely. So this nesting property I was alluding to says that indeed for nested regions, you can simultaneously, for a nested family of regions, you can simultaneously maximize the flow through all of them, the flux through all of them. And so if you want to pick, so one thing you could do, you could pick a continuous family of regions that interpolates from the empty set to the whole boundary.
Right.
And there would be a unique flow that maximizes every member of that family. Okay. So that's one way to kind of gauge fix, if you want. I just want to see if there was something I forgot.
Again, is this uniqueness is pure?
The uniqueness part, I think that's probably a theorem that hasn't been proved yet. I mean, I'm sure it's true, but actually it's interesting, not much of, like, okay, so this theorem, if you look hard enough and you know how to read the right kinds of math papers, which I don't, but my collaborator does, you can extract this theorem in a, although not quite in as full generality as we use it. So It's just not something that the differential geometers haven't talked to the graph theory people. And so all this work on Maxwell min cut, which is itself like some standard undergrad thing in computer science, you know, it's hard to find the differential geometry versions of those. So statements like the one I just made about uniqueness, you know, it's pretty clear that it's true, but it's definitely not been proven yet. Okay, so now let me just quickly do three regions. Where on earth am I on the blackboards?
The last one you wrote on was the middle one.
Well, although actually what I want, well, okay, it's okay.
But the fluxes can have a sign, then.
The threads have arrows on them, and the fluxes are signed, yes.
So it could be the case that sometimes it's negative or something?
Yeah, so it is negative here. The flux through A, let's go back to this formula. The conditional entropy of A given B is -1 in this example. And you can see that here, because if I evaluate the flux through A in V of BA, which is this, it's negative. The flux is, when I say flux through, I always mean out of. Total number of threads leaving. The total number of threads leaving A is -1.
But in that case, the entropy would be also negative.
No, the entropy of A, this is not measuring the entropy of A. This is not measuring the entropy of A. This is measuring the entropy of A.
But you might think that S of, in pure state, forget about B, but S of A versus S of A complement,
No, because you have to, because, you know, A and A complement, you know, if you want to evaluate S of A, you maximize the flux out of A. If you want to evaluate the entropy of S of A complement, you have to maximize the flux out of A complement. Now, these are related to each other. In fact, those two are equal quantities. And in fact, indeed, you simply put a minus sign and you're done. So, okay, if we do three regions, because my third complaint, it's up at the top here, was about strong subadditivity. And so I think I've addressed the first two complaints, but the third one was about strong subadditivity. And so I'll go through this rather quickly. You can evaluate, so the difference between the left and right-hand sides of strong subadditivity, I don't know how familiar everybody in the audience is with this, but anyway, it's got a name. It's called the conditional mutual information. And at least, classically, it's the mutual information between A and B conditioned on C. As always, the interpretation in the quantum context is more subtle. The formula for it, in terms of the flows, is so there's a formula which is kind of analogous to my formula for the conditional entropy. Oh, by the way, there's a couple of things I did, or at least one thing I didn't say. I don't know if you. What? No, I'm pivoting on C. Did I mess it up? I messed it up. You're right. I messed it up. Implicit in this is the subadditivity property, which is positivity of mutual information. I guess it's not terribly clear from anything I've written, but you can see. Well, in fact, let me do that. Let me do that first before doing strong subadditivity. Let me do subadditivity. Try to make it clear. I said it's the freedom to move flux between A and B. Let me make that precise. That means that assuming I maximize on AB, I still have some freedom to move between A and B, which you can think of as the difference between the maximum and the minimum. The maximum is S of A. The minimum, I've already said, is this. Right? So this thing, which I can write as the difference between the unconditional and the conditional entropy, I can write in terms of flows in this way. And I've just proven subadditivity because here, by definition, I'm maximizing on A first, and here I'm maximizing on A second. So necessarily, this cannot be less than this, okay? And similarly here, it's a little more complicated. If I don't look at my notes, I'll probably get it wrong. It's similar, but always conditioning on C, always first maximizing on C. So when you work through it, you get the following formula. First, maximize on C, then on A, then on B, or first on B. Okay, so the only difference between this and this is that I'm always now maximizing on C first. And so again, by definition, this is positive, or non-negative. This proof actually, in some ways, is simpler. I should say that the original proof that many in the room have probably seen of strong subadditivity in the holographic context that Tadashi and I published, is simple enough and everything. Although it turns out that there were some missing steps there. So if you want, you can look at a paper I wrote a couple of years ago where it's like done carefully, and it's sort of annoying actually to do it carefully. There's like very special cases and stuff. So here, I mean, it's actually simpler in some ways. But I'm not really that interested in which proof is simpler. I'm more interested in the fact that I think this reveals, you know, it's pretty clear what's going on. You measure C, condition on measuring C, how much correlation is there left between A and B? That's the conditional mutual information, okay? Also, another perhaps technical advantage of these formulas is that, let's just do this one for simplicity. If A and B are separated, if they don't share a common boundary, then this is a finite quantity. Now, if you want to use Ryutake Inagi to define it, what do? You introduce a regulator, you evaluate S of A, S of B, and S of AB, because those are separately divergent, do the subtraction, then remove the regulator. But here I don't actually have to do that. I never have to introduce a regulator, because let me rewrite this using my very advanced knowledge of math in this way, or perhaps poor knowledge of math, because I don't think a mathematician would allow themselves to switch operations like that so cavalierly, but I'm going to allow myself to do it. So this quantity is infinite, this quantity is infinite, but the difference between these flows has a finite flux. Okay, so either of these maxima, either of these max flows has an infinite flux through A and through B, but the amount that I can move from A to B is still finite in this circumstance, and I can define it by first taking the difference between these flows, and then taking then evaluating their flux. Yeah.
Why is that? S of A B itself is infinite. So in principle, we have infinitely many threads to.
But in the circumstance, I mean, I'm assuming, of course, there are circumstances where this is simply an infinite quantity. But if this is a finite quantity, which it is if A and B are both compact and separated, don't share a common boundary, then the amount that you will be free to move will be finite.
Yeah, but how do you see from the last one? I thought you were motivating that statement from the last one. I don't see how the number of threads that you're free to move from A to B, given that there are infinitely many of them,
would
be fine.
Well,
was that a direct way, or you were just?
I'm saying, if you, all I'm saying is, I mean, I'm not proving that this is finite. It's not always finite. Okay? But I'm saying, having written it this way, I no longer need a regulator. Okay?
It's not always finite, even if A and B are disjoint.
Well, I mean, there can be an infrared divergence. You know, if A and B are infinitely large or whatever.
Is the vector field the difference unique?
This vector field?
Yes.
No.
Determined.
Oh, no.
Right. It also
it's
has
still floppy.
Floppiness.
Oh, yeah.
But its
absolutely.
Integral is unique.
Its total flux is fixed. Yeah. Okay, time for open questions. I'll start with more technical ones. So the first thing is, how should I think about this tripartite information, which is the quantity which is negative in holographic theory? So we have this monogamy, quote unquote. This is a terrible name, by the way. I have no idea why we called it this.
Charles Bennett called it that way.
No, monogamy is fine, but monogamy of mutual information is a terrible name. Anyway, which says I3 is not positive. By the way, if you want to know what this means, just cross this out and write super additivity. And then it's much clearer what it means. I don't have a proof of this. And in fact, I can show that you can't prove it using the tools that I used so far. So properties of flows, like this nesting property and so on, you cannot prove this inequality from those. So flows have some additional properties that we haven't identified yet.
Sorry, Matt.
Which is interesting, yeah.
Wasn't your proof in the original proof, the statement, very similar to the proof here, in terms of the insertion?
Yeah.
What extra information do you think the flow need to have? Yeah.
I don't know. Yeah, no, the minimal surface proof did not use, I mean, I think what you're saying is the minimal surface proof didn't use any new ingredients. And by the way, there's also recent work by Ning and friends and Jamie giving an infinite family of higher inequalities in, you know, same, presumably the same deal with those. Okay, another thing is that, I mean, frankly, you know, anybody who does even any kind of quantum information theory at all should be appalled by this discussion because it's so unbelievably naive about the kinds of entanglement, the kinds of states that can be present. Of course, at the two, for two subsystems, it's not that bad. But when you get to more, then there's, of course, many different types of entanglement. It's not, you know, entanglement is not just pairwise entanglement or classical correlation. I mean, there's all this, you know, W states and GHZ states, and that's just for three subsystems. And so how is it possible that I could represent all of these different kinds of entanglement just with simple threads? You know, and each thread just goes from one subsystem to another. That's the only thing a thread can do. They don't branch or anything. So I would actually turn that around and say that I think this picture probably indicates that only some types of entanglement are possible holographically. Although I can't yet be precise about that, so I'll phrase it as a question.
But so why do you know that not all states would have this I3?
Right, so this is already...
positive.
Right. But this is not enough. I think there are problems even when you have a pure state on three subsystems, then this is automatically satisfied, but I think there are already things you can't do with this thread picture. I'm almost done. I know I'm out of time. And maybe more importantly, it's lunchtime. Okay. This one doesn't move. Okay. Higher curvature corrections. What's the analog of max flow min cut? And then quantum corrections. And here I'll just say one thing very simple, which is that one way to get some types of quantum corrections, you know, according to Faulkner, Lefkowitz, and Maldacena, you look at entanglement of the corresponding bulk region. And you can model that here by letting the threads, by essentially loosening this property that that it's divergenceless, you can, if you let threads just disappear from one bulk region and tunnel to another to represent entanglement between bulk regions, then you can model the FLM corrections to Ryu, Taki, and Nagi. Yeah, so this is essentially ER equals EPR. So it's like a little, you think of a little wormhole that connects one bulk region to another, and the thread goes through the wormhole and seems to disappear from one place and appear in another. And that models entanglement. And last but not least, perhaps most importantly, is what's going on in time-dependent cases. And I'll just say one thing, which is a partial answer, not super satisfying, but is that if you take the HRT formula in Aaron's Maximin formulation, at least it becomes a Maximax formulation, which I think is a little bit nicer. It's still a two-step thing. So you're first maximizing the flow on a given slice, then you maximize over slices. It's still not sort of, it is covariant, but in this kind of slightly awkward way. So it would be better just to have a sort of fully covariant thing where you never talk about slices at an intermediate step. Okay, that's something we're thinking about, but we don't have a definite formula yet. Thank you.
So this way of formulating RT, does it benefit us anything, or even suggest anything about non-extremal surfaces? Because you just emphasize on the fact that the extremal surface is not important anymore.
I'm not sure. I mean, I'm not sure what you're getting at.
I was just asking because you mentioned that. No, the previous way of talking about RT, the minimal surface was important.
Yeah.
So I was just wondering if it's a very naive question. In this way of talking about it, can you say anything about area of non-minimal surfaces?
I mean, I'm not sure, but I think so. One can ask, you know, can I generalize this away from, you know, ADS CFT to sort of more general quantum gravity and things like, you know, Rob's, you know, entanglement entropy of arbitrary space, you know, regions in space-time and so on. And I think the way I'd like to think about it is that you can always think of some ensemble of threads. It's not that there's one thread configuration in some given space-time, because as you move A, you can move your threads around, and even if you don't move A, you can move your threads around. So really, you should forget about A and just think about all possible flows, okay? And even just locally in some tiny region, you should think about that tiny region essentially as being defined rather than by its geometry as by the set of all possible flows, which is essentially identical to the geometry. If you know the set of all possible vector fields that obey these conditions, you know the metric. And so if you just throw away the metric and now just have some ensemble of flows, then locally you'll have, you know, maybe you can play games of the, you know, the type that I guess Ted is going to tell us more about in his talk, based on his title, of relating, you know, the Einstein equation to entanglement entropies and so on in a local fashion, and maybe all of that can be put in, you know, in the language of flows. And again, maybe Rob's entropy, you know, in quantum gravity, I forget what it was called.
What about I think you've written a paper about differential. What is this?
It's a good question. I mean, so maybe that's number six here, differential entropy. At least I have, you know, differential entropy is built out of conditional entropies. And so at least I have a nice formula for that, which might be a springboard for thinking about that, but I don't have anything snappy to say about it.
I'm curious about this ER equals EPR way to include quantum corrections. It's it seems like you, once you open that, isn't it Pandora's box? Because if you let your threads tunnel to wherever they want to go, then the topology, then the geometry of the space you're flowing through is no longer regulating what you're maximizing and what's the maximum. So how do I control the wormholes?
Well, so let's just take a conservative viewpoint first and presume that there is some fixed amount of entanglement between bulk regions. So you're in some state, and in that state, this region has some entanglement entropy. This bulk region has some entanglement entropy. You know, then that would be the thing that would limit. There would be a, some kind of, if you want, max flow, you know, in the bulk, that would limit the number of threads that are allowed to leak.
So the wormhole cross sections would be bounded, basically.
Well, or the total number would be bounded. There would be some kind of subterranean bottleneck. Okay, that would limit the total number, and it would be small. It wouldn't go like n squared. It would go be order one, but it'd be very small. Okay. Now, turning that around, you could say, well, the special, you know, holographic states that are dual to smooth geometries are very special. What's special about them? Well, they have a very small amount. They don't just have some wild topology where wormholes are going wherever they want to go. They have this very controlled, you know, smooth geometry up to some small corrections. So it's also a way to kind of think about reconstructing the bulk, if that's, you know, if that's what you like to think about. So where you start with the state, and then what does that determine about the geometry?
Yeah, I'm wondering about if you have two non-complementary regions A and B, then for mutual information, having non-zero mutual information doesn't follow that they're actually entangled, so in the sense of non-super. But,
they can just be purely classically correlated.
Right, so in your formulation, is there a way to say something about entanglement rather than...
I think that's a great question. I mean, I hinted at it here. You know, you see the difference pictorially. But of course, one, you know, and I think it may, okay, let me put it this way. Of course, one can make states that have both correlation and entanglement such that just by evaluating the conditional entropy, you wouldn't know. And by evaluating the mutual information, you wouldn't know. Is it entanglement? Is it correlation? But I think what happens there is that the fact that you have the freedom to add threads that connect A to B tells you that they are entangled. So if you look at something like a GHZ state, now just look at AB, don't look at ABC, so trace out C, okay? And then how would I draw that in this thread picture? There are two ways. One way just has a single thread coming out of A, and that gets the answers right. It tells you S of A, the conditional entropy and stuff. But somehow it's not, I think it's kind of, but at the same time, there's a freedom to draw this in a different way where it looks like this. And this, I think, is sort of more accurate. The fact that you're free, you see the fluxes are the same as what I just drew. The fact that you're free to add this extra one and shift this over means that they were entangled. Whereas I'm not sure that all states you can necessarily do that with. This is not the GHZ state. But anyway, a state where they are entangled, but the conditional entropy is zero, there are pictures you can draw that show that there is entanglement between A and B, and so. I think this is kind of, you know, getting to this question of that the thread picture kind of constrains which types of entanglement and correlation are allowed to be represented. I'm sorry, that was like a very confusing attempt to answer on the fly, but yeah. If you try to do it with like a W state or a GHZ state, you get very different pictures, actually. Yeah.
So if I think about not just not just the thread picture on the boundary, but if I go in towards the IR from the boundary and I draw some surface there, and then I count the threads that go through that particular surface. Is there some sense in which you can see the you can see that some of the threads from the original surface that was at the boundary are UV-ward of that surface, such that those threads that go from A to B don't cross?
Right. Yeah. It's it's a great question, and in fact, what I haven't done, this has all been kind of structural or kinematic, and it's, you know, so these dynamical questions about what's actually going on in the field theory should have answers, hopefully, in this language. I would say we don't really even understand the answer to that question in the usual minimal surface language, like what does it really mean for a minimal surface to kind of only reach a certain depth into the bulk and so on. I mean, there are conjectures around that, so maybe this provides a different way of.
But I think that's chunks very well, because you have, if you have your region A, there's a whole bunch of these flow lines that just go just very close to the boundary, because you can pack large amount of them.
And that's kind of UV entanglement.
So I think that picture very nicely captures.
Yeah, intuitively it's great. You know, you have UV entanglement, which are these little threads connecting A to A very close to the boundary, and then you have, you know, so yeah. Heuristically, I mean, it's great, but I mean, you, of course, one wants to be more precise. Yeah.
Okay, Veronica.
I want to come back to this ER-EPR discussion.
Yeah.
So, if you are given a state, you have the full geometry in the bulk, whereas if you have this picture of the wormholes related to your flows, this that seems very different in an essential way. Because, as we were saying, you need to specify your region of interest to specify the flows, and so it would imply that the wormholes in ER and EPR depend on your choice of A, but the bulk geometry does not. So somehow then the wormholes would have very different status.
No, I would imagine, I could, I mean, I haven't tried to make this precise, but I could definitely imagine that, you know, so there's a certain amount of bulk entanglement, you know, independent of your choice of A. I mean, just certain regions are, there's just entanglement in the bulk, of the bulk fields, right, of the bulk perturbative quantum field. And that essentially loosens this rule, wherever, the divergenceless condition. And then gives, so now you have some new constraint. The divergence is constrained by something, and then the number that leave over here is equal to the number that pop up over there, just in general, not having picked a region A. Now you pick your region A, and you maximize, given those constraints. Of course, we need to know what those rules are. But the rules would essentially encode just the fact that different parts of the bulk are entangled with each other a certain amount.
I see, so you're doing some additional construct.
Yeah, that's how I imagine. Is that a hint that it's lunchtime?
I think so. There's one last patient question.
Oh, I have a question. The question was about the graph theory literature. Is there any information you can learn about a graph given a list of all of the maps that aren't explodes? Similar to how we say maybe we can learn about the geometry given a list of
I'm totally the wrong person to ask, but that sounds like a great question. There's so much literature on Maxwell-Min cut that the hard part would be finding something like that.
Okay, with that, let's thank Maddie.